earlier pre-patriarchal form of the myth, Ariadne herself is the goddess whose womb is being threaded. Entering it and returning from it were not a hero's ordeal, but a ritual of rebirth. I discovered that initiation rites in that time often involved threading the spirals of a ritual labyrinth. The initiates moved to the sacred center, where they surrendered to a symbolic death, and then returned through the passage to symbolize their rebirth. For women on this journey, the movement through the labyrinth means threading the great womb of death and rebirth. As a woman moves into the labyrinth, she undergoes what Carolyn Heilbrunn calls the marvelous dismantling. She sheds and lets go of the old. She goes through a dying. What she is dismantling is the woman who was once asleep in her relationships, her religion, her career, and her inner life. The woman who never questioned any of it, but blindly followed prevailing ideas and dictates. She is the woman dependent on the masculine, whose life is composed of adaptable femininity. She is the woman severed from her own true instinct and creativity. She is the woman in collusion with patriarchy. When we enter the labyrinth, these parts of ourselves die little by little. The solitude and descent I'd experienced at the inn in California had meant moving into the labyrinth, an initial step toward letting the dying take place. But like most initiations, mine would be a slow dying, a long succession of one small death after another as the old identity gradually sloughed off and I let go of the values and attitudes that no longer sustained me within. Eventually, we come to what Jean Shinoda Bolen calls the core or center of meaning in ourselves, which is the center of the labyrinth. At the center of the divine womb, we begin to connect again with our feminine soul. We go to the core many times, in many ways. I had my first taste of the labyrinth's core when I found the circle of trees in the woods and felt myself reclaiming and celebrating feminine ground, discovering for the first time the woman I was and would be at soul level. The movement back out symbolizes the process of rebirth. We are taking on a new life, bringing a new consciousness back into the world, bringing more and more of the new woman into being. This was the work that stretched in front of me. But before I would thread my way back out of the labyrinth, I would go even deeper into its slow, spiraling passages. Another New Year's Eve came, and I had what could be called a dismantling experience concerning my career. My family and I were staying at a friend's house in the North Carolina mountains. A light snow was falling, dusting the cedars outside the windows. As the new year turned, I settled down before the fireplace, intending to look reflectively over the past year. The year had begun with the poem about the unexplored gorge, and had ended with finding myself ensconced in the drama of an inner myth. It had been a year of initiation. But instead of reflecting on the past year, my thoughts floated over and over to the contract I'd just signed with the inspirational magazine I wrote for. I was feeling uneasy about it. Lately, I'd been feeling a lot more tension between my writing and where my journey was taking me, a growing incongruity between my public image and my inner truth. I poked the fire and watched a swirl of sparks slip up the flue, and I felt suddenly afraid. I was a writer deeply compelled to write out the story of my soul, but when that story collided with religious boundaries, then what? I mean, if I were to write about the demise of patriarchal religion in my life, the anger and feelings of betrayal, my dissidence, my mutiny, the tug to the feminine divine, where would I find an audience? There seemed little, if any, room for such writings within the boundaries of existing religion. In truth, it was far too early to be thinking about writing any of it. Internally, I hadn't completely dissolved the old or begun to heal the wounds. I didn't have enough experience, enough cohesion inside, enough of anything. But still, the portending tension was there, a small seismic vibration of things to come. I wondered, would I have to start over with my writing career? And if I did, what would I do? Because I'd worked at Christian and inspirational writing for so long with nice success, it was hard to envision any other writing taking its place. A terrible voice inside was telling me that I couldn't do any but the old kind of writing, that I'd spent more than a decade building this particular career and public persona, and that only an idiot would walk away. It urged me to stay in line and please the powers that be, or I would drop off the face of the writing world. I tried to tell myself that I must trust the process I was in. If I lost my career, well, I lost it. But inside, the thought was frightening. That night, I dreamed. I come upon a group of people gathered around a coffin. I wonder who's died. I creep closer, close enough to see that the person in the coffin is me. I am holding an issue of the inspirational magazine with which I'd just signed the contract. And not just any issue, either. I am holding the one with me on the cover. The dream signaled a small dying inside my labyrinth. I couldn't admit it then, but my career with the magazine, indeed a career doing the kind of writing I'd been doing in the past, ended right there, though it would be nearly 2 more years before I would be able to make it official. This marvelous, and often not so marvelous, dismantling actually goes on at 2 levels, inner and outer. On the outer level, it means confronting patriarchal patterns externally within marriage, religion, culture, and career. On the inner level, it means confronting the voices of patriarchy you've internalized. Those voices are your own personal minotaur. The Minotaur. In the myth, the Minotaur, half man, half bull, lurks in the underground labyrinth beneath King Minos's palace. In the old religious ceremonies of Crete, the Minotaur represented the spirit of King Minos himself. One of the titles for the king was actually Moon Bull, and it was believed he was personified in the Minotaur. In the female psyche, the Minotaur represents negative, uncivilized, beastly, masculine power. That part of the old king driven underground. In other words, the Minotaur is the bullish, bullying, bulldozing force of patriarchy, internalized in the cellar of a woman's psyche. It is a presence that works invisibly, hampering, limiting, driving, even destroying a woman's inner and outer life. It is not surprising in a patriarchal society to find a monster like the Minotaur there at the center of the maze, writes artist Buffy Johnson. I recognized the presence of the Minotaur in my life in the belittling, driving, judging inner voice that could throw me into self-doubt or cause me to retreat. It was the voice inside that said, "You can't do that." The voice that told me I wasn't good enough, pretty enough, smart enough, capable enough. Most recently, I'd encountered it as the voice that said if I wasn't doing Christian writing, I couldn't write at all. It was the voice that censored, silenced, devalued, and criticized, sometimes driving me to higher, impossible standards. Jungians describe this inner voice in a woman's psyche as the negative animus, the inner masculine that is turned against her. But whether it is called negative animus, internalized patriarchy, or the Minotaur within, women know its power. Sylvia Plath's diary describes graphic battles with the Minotaur, whom she described as an inner voice, a demon of negation. He would seize her saying, "Oh, you can't teach, can't do anything, can't write, can't think." He robbed her of confidence, froze her into a quivering jelly, pressured her to run away from tasks where she would be fallible and flawed. Finally, she described how she mobilized herself to battle him. "I cannot ignore this murderous self. It is there. I smell it and feel it. When it says, 'You shall not sleep, you cannot teach,' I shall go on anyway, knocking its nose in. Its biggest weapon is and has been the image of myself as a perfect success in writing, teaching, and living. My demon of negation will tempt me day by day, and I'll fight it as something other than my essential self, which I am fighting to save." In the myth, Ariadne forms a bond and a plot with Theseus to kill the Minotaur. Likewise, our task is to discover and mobilize the energy inside that will battle and slay the internal Minotaur. It is an essential work of the labyrinth, destroying the brutal power of patriarchy within. A first step for me was acknowledging that the forces I was up against weren't just out there, they were also in me. Women, too, have the impulse toward dominance, aggression, and control, and we use it not just against ourselves, but also in our families and the world at large. Eddie Hillesum wrote from a Nazi concentration camp, "Each of us must turn inward and destroy in himself all that he thinks he ought to destroy in others." Starhawk says the voices from patriarchy, which attack our inherent worth, become internalized as the self-hater. It is the old king, she says, with five faces. The conqueror, who treats the self and those around us as enemies to be feared and destroyed. The orderer, who inflicts a rigid control. The master of servants, who demands that we deny our own needs and desires to serve others' ends. The censor, who keeps us silent. And the judge, who offers to restore value to us in exchange for obedience. Just let a woman start through the spirals of the labyrinth with a design on ridding herself of the Minotaur, and the self-hating voices will become a cacophony. Threatened, they rise up even stronger in the hope of holding on. They may appear with more frequency or intensity in her dreams, and their voices may harangue her in her conscious thoughts. I began to have regular visits from a patriarchal figure I called the bishop, because he often appeared in my dreams in bishop's garb. I know, of course, that most bishops aren't like the figure in my dreams. In fact, one of my friends, a retired Episcopal bishop, is pretty much the opposite of my inner bishop, and I feel a little like apologizing to him and bishops everywhere that my Minotaur took this form. But then, dreams have a mind of their own. The bishop represented the authoritarian, oppressive, patriarchal voice, a part of myself that thwarted the new woman who wanted to come into being. His message was, "Get back in line and be quiet." In one dream, he destroyed some of my writings about my feminist experience, echoes of the Bishop of Constantinople, who in 350 CE ordered the writings of the poet Sappho burned wherever found, condemning her voice throughout the world. The bishop also appeared in various other forms to remind me that real authority, divinity, and power were rooted in men, that I was, after all, just a woman. Understand, this wasn't my conscious attitude. Dreams are symbolic expressions of the hidden and half-glimpsed truths that operate in the dark, in our blind spots. They reveal what's unconscious to us, but what nevertheless affects our thoughts, feelings, and motives. It's important to recognize when we are caught by the bishop's power, when we give in to self-doubt, the impulse to pull back, the scramble to get back in line, to please, to go silent, or to berate ourselves. "You can't do it. Why try? You aren't capable enough, stupid woman." Or, conversely, the bullish need to prove ourselves may rise up so that we drive ourselves. Strive, work, harder, harder, get it perfect, perfect, perfect. Keep fooling 'em. Whenever the bishop came, I tried to bring him to consciousness, where I could challenge his authority and begin to depotentiate his power. I reminded myself that his opinion was not who I was, but only an aspect of me, my own negative masculine. Nevertheless, this kind of work is never quick and easy. After many months, I had a dream that affected me very deeply. I am shut up in the bishop's house and feeling terribly ill. I have a desperate need to vomit, and I beg the bishop for a trash can so I can throw up. He adamantly refuses. I feel that if I don't vomit, I will die, and I keep pleading with him, but he is determined to keep me from vomiting. I woke nauseated, depressed. I came to realize that my urgent necessity to vomit symbolized my need to expel the whole patriarchal ideology that I'd swallowed and that was now making me sick. I had the inexplicable feeling that my feminine soul was somehow at stake, but spiritually, psychologically, I could not throw up. I became full of doubt that I would ever get out of the bishop's house. I grew discouraged. My analyst suggested I re-enter the dream where it left off, using Jungian active imagination. I was to close my eyes and let the images come without directing them, without conscious choreography. Once again, I found myself begging for a trash can so I could throw up. But this time, as the images played on the screen in my head, I was startled to see myself growing a massive pair of antlers. Of all things, antlers. I lowered my head and tossed the bishop across the room, then ran through the wall of the house. Outside in a nearby woods, while the bishop's house collapsed on his head, I finally threw up. I relieved myself of all the stuff that had poisoned my insides. Throwing up while wearing antlers, it was such an odd, ludicrous image, I began to laugh. My depression and doubts left almost immediately. At home, I pulled books off my shelf to see what I could find out about the deer as a symbol. Somehow I was not surprised to find the deer was an animal associated with Artemis, the Greek goddess of independent women. After this, the bishop's presence became much weaker, his appearances fewer and fewer, until he rarely, if ever, appeared at all. I told Sandy about the bishop and the antlers, and soon after he presented me with an actual pair of deer antlers that a friend of his had found in the woods. Besides being a wonderful gift, it was a strong sign of his growing support for my journey. I hung the antlers on my wall, a reminder that as women, we must sprout the strength to break the power of patriarchy in our inner lives. I wanted to create a ritual to support the work of dismantling patriarchy. When I mentioned the idea to my friend Betty, we decided we would carry out a ritual funeral for patriarchy. We would enact externally what we were trying to do internally. At Springbank, on a winter weekend, we placed a number of objects symbolizing patriarchy in our lives inside a shoebox, coffin, and carried the box to the woods. We dug a small hole and squeezed the box inside, spoke the words we needed to say to lay it to rest, covered the coffin with the dirt, and marked the spot with a stone. Then we had our wake. The ritual didn't magically end the power of patriarchy in my life, but it did create an intention, a feat for my soul to replicate. Like most rituals, it was an act of leavening that would go on working in me for months, probably even years. "If we leave our father's house, we have to make ourselves self-reliant," writes Marion Woodman. "Otherwise, we just fall into another father's house. If we don't keep up the work of burying patriarchy, we may climb out of one oppressive situation only to land in another. We may get rid of one facet of the bishop, only to have him show up in another guise, sometimes a far subtler one. He may turn up as a benevolent, kind-faced dictator who gets you back in line, not through bullying, but by his caring. Father knows best. But benevolent patriarchy is still patriarchy. For a woman, slaying the Minotaur is a spiritual work, not only because it brings her redemption and new life, but because in freeing ourselves, we help to free the world. Writer Cynthia Eller reminds us, "We need to concentrate upon changing our internal reality, knowing that as the foundations of oppression inside us crumble, external patriarchal reality must give way." Or, as Charlene Spretnak writes, "We are building a revolution of the psyche as well as of society." Following the Inner Thread. On another cold weekend visit to Springbank, I wandered into the woods to plant a handful of spring bulbs in the circle of trees that, even at its winter barest, was still a mirror of the feminine ground within. Confronting the bishop, confronting patriarchal voices that held me hostage to old patterns, had been painful. I was feeling, really feeling, how wounded my feminine life was, how wounded the feminine was, and feeling, too, the betrayal, the anger, the sense of being a woman homesick for her female soul, homesick at home. I had been struggling with the changes that were sweeping through my life, trying to recreate my marriage, responding to people who wanted to know why I wasn't at church, worrying, feeling torn. Things were a mess. When you're in the midst of initiation, when your old womanhood is dying away, you may think you'll be stuck in the dying place forever. You cannot see beyond it. It is hard to keep moving, to put one foot in front of the other, because they are always landing on some new and unfamiliar plot of ground, and half the time that place is a swamp. For weeks I'd been walking in swamps, feeling lost. I didn't know which way to go next. So here I was, back at the circle of trees with a bag of daffodil bulbs. Hardly anything affirms rebirth to me like daffodil bulbs. Put those seemingly dead brown lumps in the ground, and they will defy rock, storm, and pestilence to emerge and unfurl themselves. I dug the holes and placed the bulbs in the ground. Patting the earth over them, I thought about the invisible force inside the bulb, which moves it toward life. And it occurred to me, the thing in the daffodil bulb is in me, too. I knew then the only thing to do was reconnect with the thread that had been tugging me along on this journey and hang on for dear life. I thought about the thread in the Ariadne story, of Joseph Campbell's words, "That's all you need, an Ariadne thread." In the myth, Ariadne gives Theseus a saving thread to follow into the labyrinth and back out. For a woman, the thread symbolizes the umbilical cord of the goddess, the life cord that sustains you as you move through the spirals of the great womb. Your Ariadne thread is the thread of your feminine soul, your wisdom and intuition, the voice of your feminine self. I imagine it spinning out from my solar plexus, ready to guide me. Thread is closely associated with the idea of destiny, or fate. In mythology, one's life thread was spun, measured, and cut by the three fates. We each have an inner destiny, one imprinted in the soul. This destiny is contained in us the way a daffodil is contained inside a daffodil bulb. Each of us also possesses a very goal-directed energy that seeks to bring the seed of ourselves to fruition. It pulses inside us, trying to complete who we are uniquely meant to be. There's even a name for this energy in science, entelechy. That, however, is a mouthful, so I simply call it big wisdom. This energy is really the wise force that spins the Ariadne thread, wanting to take us toward our fulfillment as women. Unfortunately, most of us either ignore big wisdom or thwart it. The day I planted the bulbs in the circle of trees, I became aware that whenever I'd trusted my truth as a woman and was loyal to it, it had become like a thread in my fingers, unwinding, guiding, taking me where I needed to go. When I denied it and refused to trust, refused to pick up the thread, I became lost, afraid, off-center, like now. The way to find your thread again is to be still and remember who you are, to listen to your heart, your inner wisdom, as deeply as you can, and then give yourself permission to follow it. If you can't give yourself this permission, then find someone who can. Everybody should have at least one permission giver in her life. Betty and I have been daring one another into being for years now. Once when we were letting our playful selves come out, we climbed a tree beside a river, one of its huge limbs arched out over the water, and after prodding and encouraging one another, we climbed out onto it and sat there together, watching the river rush beneath us. After a while, she looked at me and started laughing. She said, "What we're doing right now captures one of the best parts of our friendship, the way we keep going out on limbs together." The best female friendships are about encouraging full personhood, giving the other permission to follow her big wisdom, even when it means going out on a limb, even when it means her thread takes her away from safe conventionalities. When I left the circle of trees that day, I had picked my thread back up. I could feel my own thread leading me onto a path all my own, and I knew I would need all the permission I could get in order to follow. Soon after this, Betty and I decided to ritualize threading the labyrinth. Returning to Springbank on a spring day, when the woods were fragrant with wisteria, we unwound several hundred yards of textile thread from a huge spool, laying the thread along the narrow trails in a spiraling fashion so that it eventually led into the circle of trees at the center. That night, we intended to move singly through the woods without flashlights, holding the thread and following it through the darkness. Navigating a dark, unknown space by thread alone is a lesson in trusting the thread of your own soul. I didn't appreciate what that meant until I stepped alone into the blackness of the woods, reached down, and lifted up the white string, barely perceptible except as a faint trace of silver extending a few feet in front of me. When we'd first planned the ritual, it had seemed like a good idea, but as I began to feel my way along the path, I kept thinking, how did I get here, doing this? It was one of those moments common in feminist spiritual journeys, when part of you steps out of the experience and watches it like a shocked observer, the way your mother might watch it, and you wonder how in the name of good sense you got there. But the deeper knowing part of me was still immersed in the moment, was still thrusting beyond the borders of my known world. I kept walking. I held on and moved one step at a time, turning when the string turned, knowing that if I abandoned it, I would be quite lost. It took nearly an hour of inching my way along the trail before I finally moved into the circle of trees. There, the moon poured down and lit the clearing. I moved to the center of it with a sense of coming to the center of myself, coming to the core. Betty had already arrived in the circle, having set out some time before me. Together we sat, contemplating what we'd just done. Across the circle, the daffodils were blooming bright. Rebirth. As I struggled to cling to my thread and go where it took me, inevitable moments of rebirth began to happen. One took place that same spring as I sat in the blue wing chair in my analyst's solarium, a place I'd been coming to sit for a long while now. That day, I told her, I suppose this new part of me that's coming into being can't go on writing forever in the same way, but it's where my success is, my income. So many people expect this of me. I don't see how I can possibly leave it. As I said the words, I felt suddenly on the verge of tears. I couldn't imagine turning this way of writing loose, even though I knew deep down my thread was spinning in another direction. I was like a scared, belligerent child on the first day of school, holding on to anything I could to prevent being dragged to my destiny. She gave me a long, deliberate look. If you write to please others, or write for success, or stardom, or money, you're writing out of your ego. When are you going to write out of yourself? I could not answer her. I had never even considered the issue in this light. For a second, I almost resented her showing it to me, this clear, true choice. You're outgrowing the old way, she said. You're being asked to create from your feminine soul. What flickered unbidden through my mind was a desire I'd harbored from the inception of my writing life, the desire to write fiction, something that had always seemed a remote and implausible prospect. I would have to start over. I would lose so much, speaking engagements, money, safety, security. I felt like Jo in Little Women when she realizes that what she is writing is no longer from the purity of her soul, and she mutters, I almost wish I hadn't any conscience. It's so inconvenient. Besides, there were no guarantees that if I gave all that up, I could succeed with fiction or any other sort of writing. I was starting to realize that in some ways, my career as it was had become my identity, and as such, it seemed impossible to shed. I don't know if I can do it, I told her. Then for the first time, I heard a sharp edge enter her voice. She looked at me solemnly, sternly, and asked, Do you have anything to say to your generation of women or not? Inside me, something gave way and let go. Her words became tiny keys unlocking the place inside where I'd been trapped. It still amazes me how this process works. The key words from the enabling person coming at the height of our readiness after we've tried so long to pick the lock ourselves, enter the lock with a resounding click. Late that same afternoon, I took my journal to the patio and wrote, Why didn't I see this before, that my creative life is my deepest prayer, that I must pray it from my heart, from my soul, not from my head or my need for security or approval or to gain some sort of repute? What did she say to me? I must write from the self, the deep and true place, not from the ego. And now, oddly, there is something inside me, something thick, full, and chaotic like water just before it boils. Write your personal story, it tells me. Write your female experience, but go deeper, further. Write unbarred, untethered. Say what you want and need to say. Forget selling the words or pleasing. Just do it. Just do it. The words sound so wise, so simple, even if they are from a Nike ad. But I remember that long before Nike was a shoe company, there was Nike, goddess of victory. There is this other clamoring in me, too, the desire I've carried around but never dared, the thing I thought I could never do. Now, here it is, the urge to create characters and stories, the ones that are mine to tell. Fiction, the passion tells me. Fiction. So my thread is spinning new courses, and my thread, like my dreams, never lies, never leads me astray. Still, I cannot stop thinking how brave I will have to be to follow it. Rebirth was happening slowly in other ways, too. The many-breasted mother was starting to decay in earnest. I remember an utterly simple moment when I felt her going and something new rising to fill her place. I was standing in my son's room, putting a stack of clean clothes on top of his dresser. I looked at his high school picture wedged between the old soccer trophies, and I thought, no, I didn't think, I knew. Their lives are theirs to live. My life is mine to live. That's all, just this thought that swept through me and changed my mental landscape. I felt as if I'd been released. I sat on my son's bed, just taking it in. When I stood up, I no longer had that bittersweet need inside that mothers know so well, the one driven by love and nurture gone overboard, that need to bend, spindle, and spread ourselves over the lives of our children as if we are the St. Louis Gateway Arch. I felt it go, the need to oversee and manage all the aspects of their lives, the need to work constantly, relentlessly to make them into happy people and their world into a perfect place, as if they had little steering wheels protruding from their backs, and it was my job to drive their lives around, never taking my hands off the wheel for fear they would bump into something, get lost, rear-end things, run a caution light, show up late, miss the destination. Ultimately, I was not responsible for the living of their lives. They were at the helm of their own lives, and I was suddenly willing to let that be, to let them pilot their courses, make their mistakes, learn their lessons, choose their roads, and take on for themselves the job of being human. Somehow I think this deep release needs to take place before a many-breasted mother can take up her own life fully. Released of the need to oversee, over-nurture, and over-manage, a woman's life becomes newly her own. The demise of my secondary partner had been going on for some time now, as Sandy and I renovated our marriage. There were many renewals, but I particularly remember one small event that took place that same spring. Betty and I decided to travel to Santa Fe for a week, just two female friends leaving husbands at home and taking off on vacation. Spontaneous adventure, we called it. At an earlier time in our marriage, such a trip would not have been considered. Today it seems like such a small thing, but at the time, making that choice and carrying it out was an initiation in itself. In a symbolic way, it marked the end of an old way of being married and signaled the beginning of a new autonomy. In New Mexico, Betty and I hiked mountains, explored gorges, and tramped around in the desert. Left to ourselves, we became downright plucky. In town, we bought audacious straw hats, stuck big feathers in them, and wore them everywhere, laughing at our reflections in store windows. I noticed we walked differently in those hats. We went just where we wanted to go, and we went with our chins flung back. We had caught the spirit of belonging to ourselves. And when we got off the plane back home, still wearing those hats, our husbands, who'd come to meet us, looked at us and then at each other. "I see you had fun," Sandy said, smiling. Rather than dilute our relationship, the freedom I was claiming helped solidify it. For in the long run, when a woman breaks out of boxes that have limited her, when she sets her plucky self free and begins to nourish and enrich herself, her relationships are nourished and enriched as well. In fact, Sandy seemed to like the woman who climbed mountains and wore the audacious hat. With that experience, more than any other, I felt the crumbling of the old patriarchal foundation our marriage had rested upon in such hidden and subtle ways. Though both of us would always need to compromise, there was no more sacrificing myself, no more revolving around him, no more looking to him for validation, trying to be what I thought he needed me to be. My life, my time, my decisions became newly my own. The silent woman inside began to slowly unmuzzle herself. I first recognized her rebirth when I spoke at a conference for church women. I planned to give a speech I'd delivered several times before, and the evening before, hunched over a little desk in my guest room, I pulled out my notes and read over them. "This isn't my real voice," I thought. "This voice belongs to a woman speaking the father tongue, a woman stifling her deeper truths, a woman interested in being safe and approved of." The real stuff was silenced. I went to the window and gazed at the grounds of the conference center sloping down to the banks of a river. I was groping around for courage. I went back to the desk, took a red pen in my hand, and struck out sentences. I wrote furiously between the lines, up the margins, on the back of the paper, writing things that came from my soul, truths I'd never dared, words about women in search of their souls, about the feminine divine. To show you what a grand humor the dream voice can have, that night I dreamed I was staring at a picture of Nefertiti, the Egyptian queen who was known for her unusually long and beautiful neck. The picture accentuated the elongation of her neck, and I was struck by how unique and magnificent it was. I stretched out my own neck and was startled as it, too, lengthened. I woke laughing at the image, thinking, "Yeah, I'm about to stick my neck out all right. But it's okay, even beautiful." I broke my silence before 500 women. Not all of them were happy about that. In fact, a few were so distressed they organized a letter-writing campaign to me and to one of the magazines I wrote for, expressing their anger. Dozens of letters poured in. One suggested that I was a dangerous woman. A dangerous woman. I smile every time I think of it. The writer did not mean it as a compliment, but I took it that way. I remembered the old woman who told me that one day we may all owe our survival to subversive women. Dangerous ones, too, I thought. I fell into a soup of controversy. I had to swim my way out or sink. At first, I felt overwhelmed, lamenting the loss of support and approval. But as the blow wore off, I experienced the freedom and enlargement that comes from unsilencing the feminine soul, from being true to myself. But perhaps the most vibrant rebirth going on inside me was the transformation of the church handmaid. My thread had already led me away from the religious collective, away from its projections about what a favored daughter of the church ought to do and be, and I was fretting less over what my friends and family would think. I was also beginning to name my own spiritual meaning. Already I had named a myth that could hold a feminine spiritual process, claiming the thing most denied to church handmaids, the creation of spiritual myth, symbol, and meaning. But mostly I sensed rebirth as my heart opened wider toward the divine feminine presence. Landing on Naxos. In June, Sandy and I flew to London to spend a week. As we were wandering through the National Gallery, we came unexpectedly upon Titian's gargantuan painting of Ariadne on the island of Naxos. The painting portrays the final part of Ariadne's myth, and I played it back in my mind as I gazed at the picture. Before Theseus had entered the labyrinth, he had promised to take Ariadne with him when he escaped, a promise she'd extracted in exchange for the ball of thread. When the Minotaur has been slain, they flee the realm of King Minos together. Ariadne, defying her father, leaves her old life forever. They sail to the island of Naxos, where they stop for the night. The next morning, however, when Ariadne wakes, she discovers that Theseus has sailed on without her. She is alone in a strange place. But something dramatic is about to happen. and the painting captures it perfectly. It shows Ariadne standing desolate on the shore, watching Theseus's ship disappear on the horizon. Her hand is reaching out toward the ship, but her head is turned back toward the island, as she is startled in mid-gesture by the sudden arrival of the Greek god Dionysus. He is leaping from his chariot to console and love her. Ariadne's face registers surprise, her lips parted as if saying, "Oh my, what's this?" It's obvious that the ship receding into the distance is her past, and that in turning to meet the gaze of Dionysus, she is meeting her future. The myth tells us that the two marry and create a deep and lasting love, that Dionysus gives her a crown as a sign of his devotion. She goes on to become leader of the annual sacred dance performed by the Maenads, the dancing women who honor Dionysus. Along with him, she becomes enshrined in the Villa of Mysteries at Pompeii as the overseer of women's mysteries, to be known as the wise mentor who initiates women into the feminine journey. But what did all of this signify in the life and journey of a woman like me? I'd focused mainly on the stages of the myth that lead a woman out of the father world and through the labyrinth, meditating little on Ariadne's arrival in Naxos. But now, confronted unexpectedly with that part of the story, I went and sat on a nearby bench and tried to sort out the meaning. I recalled that one of the dangers in leaving the realm of the old king is that in our desperation and pain, we will create a savior out there because we cannot recognize our own strength, daring, creativity, and power. So if, like Ariadne, we find some external Theseus on whom to project the savior role, we will eventually face a moment of truth. Theseus's leaving suggested to me that the last of a woman's dependence on male deliverers must be stripped away. She needs to see that the external Theseus is really an extension of the patriarchal father, another male figure upon whom she's dependent. Theseus's departure forces a woman back completely upon herself. She learns that to become fully reconnected with her feminine soul, the projection must be withdrawn. Now she must set about the business of discovering within herself the daring hero strength she saw in Theseus. In doing this, she renders herself independent of patriarchal values and judgments. So here is Ariadne on Naxos, abandoned to herself, abandoned to new possibility. But whatever could the arrival of Dionysus imply for a woman? I got up from the bench and wandered back to the bookshop in the National Gallery, where I picked up a book on mythology. I leafed through the index for Dionysus. I was not surprised to find that he was the god of women, a god close to and inclusive of the feminine. One of the animals he was associated with was the snake, often a symbol of the divine feminine. Jean Shinoda Bolin indicates that as Dionysus traveled through Greece in his mythological travels, he called women away from their household hearths and looms, liberating them from conventional narrow roles. He was also the god of dance, joy, creativity, spirit, and wine, the god of ecstasy. I walked back to the painting. As I looked at the figure of Dionysus, it hit me that, unlike Theseus, who was a mortal man in the myth, Dionysus was an immortal god. In other words, he symbolized an inner figure. He represented something Ariadne must find within. As Jungian analyst Nancy Qualls Corbett points out, at this point in a woman's life, she can begin to appreciate the strength of the god within, who emerges at this crucial point without threatening her budding connection to her feminine nature. With the arrival of Dionysus, we meet a positive masculine force, one that supports women and the feminine from within, one that helps a woman manifest her new vision and voice in the world. Dionysus, I realized, is the opposite of the Minotaur. When a woman works consciously and diligently to slay her Minotaur, she makes a way for Dionysus to come. I began to pace around in front of the painting, feeling excited. I realized that the arrival of Dionysus is a momentous time in a woman's life. It is when she knows that she is beginning to find completion and wholeness in herself, and I couldn't help feeling I was on the verge of this step myself. I remembered that in the myth, Ariadne and Dionysus are wed, symbolizing an intermarriage of the positive masculine and the conscious feminine. When these two aspects of ourselves come together within, we arrive at new wholeness, new completion. As C.G. Jung taught, wholeness is not achieved by cutting off a portion of one's being, but by integration of the contraries. A woman who finds this integration can assume her own authority as a woman. She becomes a woman with a true feminine center and an inner masculine partner who is supportive and helpful. And no telling what sort of new creative children could be born from such a union, I thought. My husband had long since wandered off to see the rest of the paintings, and I found him now in a little sea of people in the next room, his head cocked in a funny way as he looked at a picture I couldn't see. Looking at him, I realized that a woman who finds wholeness does not have to have an external man in order to be complete. She can choose this, but she is not dependent on it for her wholeness. But in the same moment, still staring at him, I also knew that I chose him with all my heart. He was a human man, and I was a human woman, and here we were, both of us with all our faults, struggling along, moving on our parallel journeys. I knew I didn't need him to be a Theseus or a Dionysus. He could be what he was. That day in the museum, it seemed to me that I had at last landed on Naxos. Like Ariadne, I had left the father world and crossed over to a new place. Like her, I had watched the last ship sail, then turned, knowing that it was time to look within. So now what? I wondered if I could begin to find my own positive inner masculine, while at the same time forging a connection with my feminine soul and allowing myself to be led by that connection. Could I bring together the deep splits inside, find healing, and tap new creativity? Could I begin the process of assuming my own authority as a woman? What, I wondered, would I discover on my Naxos? Sandy was crossing the room, coming toward me.
"The gallery is about to close and you've hardly seen anything," he said.
I smiled. Part 3. Grounding. As I go into her, she pierces my heart. When I have reached her center, I am weeping openly. I have known her all my life, yet she reveals stories to me, and these stories are revelations, and I am transformed. Susan Griffin. Until women can visualize the sacred female, they cannot be whole, and society cannot be whole. Eleanor Gaydon. As I left the museum and walked out onto Trafalgar Square, I had the sense that a new season of my journey was beginning. After a year and a half of initiation, moving with the tumultuous rhythms of dying and rebirth, it was time to ground myself in a new feminine place. You know how you feel when you get off a boat that has been pitching around on the sea, and the ground still seems to be moving under your feet? Inwardly, I felt like that. I'd traversed a body of experience, riding the roils and swells of change, and while much change still remained, I'd moved through enough initiation that I could begin to anchor myself in the new place where I'd arrived. I leaned against the massive lion statue in front of the museum while Sandy snapped a picture. Things around us swirled, people hurrying, London traffic jostling around the square, flurries of pigeons taking to the sky. It only heightened my sense of need to become grounded and moored. To meet that need, I knew I needed to sink my roots deep into sacred feminine experience, to deepen and fortify my budding relationship with my new female self and the divine feminine. Encountering Goddess. We were driving, Sandy and I, on the wrong side of the road through English countryside, which undulated like a quilt of overwashed colors, heather greens, faded blues, browns paling into tan and chalk. We were on our way from Oxford to Glastonbury when unexpectedly we found ourselves in the village of Avebury, gazing through car windows at a monumental stone circle spread through a sheep field, a circle like Stonehenge, only far larger. "What's this?" I asked, amazed that these megalithic structures had appeared seemingly in the middle of nowhere.
"I have no idea," said Sandy. "Wanna stop?"
I was already pulling on my coat, reaching for the tourist book to see if I could identify the place. "Listen to this," I said as we pulled into a small parking lot set aside for visitors to the stone circle. "Avebury was a religious center dating back to the 3rd millennium BCE. It says here that the arrangement of the stones may have represented the shape of the body of the goddess."
"Goddess?" asked Sandy. His eyebrows went up, very high.
"Yes," I said, smiling at the look on his face. "Goddess." The word no longer caused disquiet for me. My earlier anxiety had derived from the way the word had unfairly been associated with things base and sordid, from the long historical repression and despising of the divine feminine, and from the taboos against women seizing the power to name sacred experience from their own perspective. When I understood this and unloaded all that baggage off the word, I was left with a mere word which pointed to a female power of being. But I sensed Sandy's discomfort, so I tried to unpack the word for him, too. I told him about some of the things I'd been reading for the last 6 months or so, the work of UCLA archaeologist Maria Gimbutas, who'd studied and written about the goddess-worshipping, earth-centered cultures of prehistory, as well as other books I'd read by female scholars, anthropologists, art historians, and theologians who were recovering the rich history of goddess, a history that had been lost or suppressed. And as I talked, I felt again the amazement that first washed over me as I began to discover that for many thousands of years before the rise of the Hebrew religion, in virtually every culture of the world, people worshipped the supreme being in the form of a female deity, the great goddess. He seemed open and interested, and so as we walked toward the field with the circle of stones, I told him some particular things I'd learned about her, that she was known as the creator and sustainer of the universe who ruled over the rhythms and forces of nature, that she was all-wise, all-knowing, all-powerful, bringing both birth and death, light and dark. I explained that she was immanent, compassionate, ever-nourishing, associated with earth, fertility, and sexuality, but also a transcendent being who bestowed order, justice, and truth.
"But weren't there a lot of goddesses?" he asked.
"She certainly had lots of forms and names," I said, and my mind returned to the Minoan snake goddess of Crete, represented by a woman holding a snake in each hand, the image I'd discovered through my dreams.
"So what happened to her?" Sandy wanted to know.
We had reached the field and began to walk now along an avenue of wide-spaced stones. I felt very moved inside, being in this place. I thought about his question, about the global phenomenon that had taken place, probably beginning in the 3rd millennium BCE, some kind of patriarchal revolution that spanned around 2,500 years, during which there was a massive shift from female goddess to male god. "She disappeared," I said. "In some cases she was conquered, sometimes violently, by cultures worshipping a male sky god. Basically, she went through a series of demotions as the male god ascended, until finally she got demoted out of sight. Not only that, but her memory was maligned, distorted, and suppressed. She was hardly mentioned in history books." We walked on in silence. I was thinking how her passage into oblivion had happened not only historically, but also deep within the psyches and consciousness of human beings. With her disappearance came a sweeping demotion in women's status. Concepts of female inferiority and subordination began to develop in earnest. Over the last few months, this untaught history had become a lump in my throat, a forgotten piece of my female heart that had begun to beat again. Now, here in the stone circle, I felt it even more, like a sad, sad sweetness, like a sorrow and a hope melded into one. The light was soft and dimly fogged, as it can be only in England, so that looking at the stones was like gazing through a steamed window. I walked through the field with a weight of longing and love lodged in my chest, like a cumulus cloud ready to burst into rain and thunder after a long drought. I moved from one stone to another, placing my hand flat against their surfaces, the same way I had moved around the circle of trees, placing my hand flat against the trunks. One stone had a hollow place with a white votive candle sitting inside it. The candle had been lighted recently, for the wax was still warm. As Sandy scouted for high ground in order to take a picture, I fished in my purse for the hotel matches I'd picked up as a souvenir, struck one, and lit the candle. A few minutes later, from somewhere, a flute began to play. Clear, pure Celtic notes floated in the air behind me. I looked around to see a woman on a knoll about 40 yards away, her head weaving as she piped the music. Other tourists turned and stared. No one seemed to have any idea who she was or why she was there playing the flute, but I knew somehow that she was a woman like myself, a woman with the sacred feminine full to bursting in her chest, and that she was the one who'd lit the candle earlier. In the haze-blown light, with the notes of the woman's music in the air, the fullness inside me broke. Divine feminine love came, wiping out all my puny ideas about love in one driving sweep. Today I remember that event for the radiant mystery it was, how I felt myself embraced by Goddess, how I felt myself in touch with the deepest thing I am. It was the moment when, as playwright and poet Endozaki Shange put it, I found God in myself, and I loved her fiercely. I could not have distinguished then the difference between discovering the ancient goddess and discovering goddess within myself. It was too soon. I knew only that in some deep way, I had encountered her. Sandy walked over, looked at the burning candle, at my eyes full of tears, then at the woman still playing her flute. Later that moment would remind me of a line in the play Julian about the Christian mystic Julian of Norwich. Though many thought she had lost her wits, I knew that she had found her soul. Why a feminine form for the formless? One hot day in July, not long after returning from England, I was sitting in my study reading when I came upon this statement by Vanderbilt theologian Sally McFaig. God is she, he, and neither. As I pondered it, the statement brought back what I had always known as true, the genderless, formless nature of the divine. I was aware that Jewish and Christian theologians point out that God is genderless. The ultimate ground of being, the divine one, is neither male nor female. N.E. Carr says, no image or symbol is an adequate picture of God. In the Bible, God names God, saying, I am that I am. The absolute being simply is. It participates in the form or symbol. It is in or behind the picture, but it always transcends them. The question then occurred to me, well, if that's so, if the divine is ultimately formless and genderless, what's the big deal? Why all this bother? The bother is because we have no other way of speaking about the absolute. We need forms and images. Without them, we have no way of relating to the divine. Symbol and image create a universal spiritual language. It's the language the soul understands. And yet, and here was the crux, the images that have pervaded our speech, thought, and feeling about the divine have told us the divine is exclusively male. They have told us there is only one form, and that form is masculine. Indeed, the image, language, and metaphor of God as male has been used so exclusively for so long, about 5,000 years, that most people seem to believe God really is male. McFaig points out that when only one image is allowed to serve as the grid for speaking about God, it becomes idolatrous. It comes to be viewed not as symbol, but as fact, as an actual description. I'd read Paul Tillich's work years before and accepted his view that the transcendent always transcends every symbol used to describe it, that a symbol may point to God or participate in the reality of God, but that God cannot be identified as that. Tillich pointed out the tendency of religions to substitute symbols for the divine itself, which he referred to as a tendency toward idolatry. My friend and mentor, Dr. Beatrice Bruto, once described it to me like this. The absolute reality, the I am, can be likened to a dancer, and the forms that the absolute